During this week, what I plan to do is present and hope to bring forth discussion about the renewal movement of Luther and also what it means to have Luther as somewhat of a spiritual ancestor still influencing our life and our world today. And part of my reason, I suppose there are many, but it's a memory and almost a memorial that in the early days at Holden Village, there was a wonderful, wonderful little man that used to be here bringing joy to this place, bringing joy to children, and also almost daily bringing the joy of Martin Luther's teaching to this place. Does anybody remember? Way back? Roland Bainton, who's maybe was America's greatest Luther scholar, wrote the definitive biography that we read, remember, Here I Stand. And he also loves to draw pictures of children, and he used to have children lining up for him to sketch their pictures. And even, I don't know what age he was when he died, I think it was late 80s, he was still riding his bicycle around Yale, where he taught, am I right? And I want to, in a way, say that in a small way, in an inadequate way, I think, is to carry on his tradition here at Holden Village. And begin with the story, and I think it was Gertrude Lundholm, whom maybe many of you know from being up here many years, bringing so much grace to this place that I'll have to check if this was her, but the day that she found out that Roland Bainton was not a Lutheran. And part of my reason for beginning with this story is to, if some of you here are not Lutherans or Lutheran background or Lutheran tradition, this is a way of saying welcome, because America's greatest Luther scholar was not a Lutheran. Well, she was shocked, you know, when she found this out. You know, how could the great Luther scholar not be a Lutheran? So she went to ask him. And at least as the story goes, she says, how could you spend your entire life studying Luther, being with Luther, writing about Luther, and not be a Lutheran? And with a twinkle in his eye, he said, if I ever found a Lutheran church, I'd join it. Now, does that, and nobody ever really asked him, I think, to define what he meant by that. Would anybody like to guess? What do you think Roland Bainton might have meant by that? Anybody dare?
I would guess that what happens is so often is that this has been one of the things I've followed rather with great interest. I'm a musician. Mm-hmm. You've heard of Suzuki, Shinichi Suzuki, who started the method of teaching very young children playing violin. Anyone that can learn to play, to speak Japanese, he said, by imitation, can learn to play the violin. And that was his basic thesis, but a lot more to that, and a lot of it what his book called Nurtured by Love. But there are so many, many, many people who call themselves Suzuki teachers that he would not recognize. He would disown them. Mm-hmm. That perhaps what he's saying is that if I ever found a church that was really Lutheran in practice, in doctrine, following what Luther really was, that...
Yeah. So one way to put it is that maybe Luther really caused an explosion. And I hope we can get in touch with that in a small way. And what we do after explosions is the followers run in to put out the fire. You know, stop it before it gets out of control. Stop. And maybe that's what he meant. Was there a spirit that kind of burst forth at in the 16th century, the time of Martin Luther and his renewal and his reform, that maybe was so powerful and everything that we who are his followers tend to be almost afraid of it? And part of the challenge and the call was, or how can you know, you who maybe are not part of the Lutheran Church, you know, sense a little of what this was, how can we who are say, is there a way to reclaim this, or again to feel the warmth and the heat of that fire and that explosion? Go ahead.
Well, the thought that goes to my mind is the comment or the last night at the church, we were talking about that, and the sermon was talking about this, the renewal or the change that all of a sudden somebody turned the light bulb on and you see some change and you go from there. And then all the rest of it, try and fit it into a neat little organization.
Yeah.
And I see a real antithesis there, where a man like Luther was not the product of an organization. Yeah. He was, again, the antithesis.
Right.
And it's going to disappear, and it's going to get changed, and it's going to get molded to fit what we are all comfortable with, and I can understand very well where he's coming from. Why he never found a Lutheran church.
And part of my hope here is the is for us to be able to ask the question, is there a way to reclaim some of the wonder? And I have a personal agenda too, because I believe there are many Lutheran congregations that are saying the way to truly be alive, effective in America is to really leave our Lutheran heritage and go after that which looks popular or seems to be selling or seems to be working. And part of, I think, my concern about sharing with Luther this week is why not look and see what is so exciting and so alive and so vital, and why not try to find that again, and then again let that be a light instead of saying, well, let's kind of push this aside, I think it's boring. And then, oh my goodness, look at that church over there, that mega church. You know, let's do it the way they're doing it. You know, that's what's important today. So just in case some of you wondered if I have any prejudices, current prejudice involved in my sharing this week, I might. I just might. So, I'd like to begin with this story that there's maybe a few times that I've been in touch with the fire, and one day it actually happened kind of unintentionally or accidentally. Maybe I was tired, but I served a congregation in San Diego for 5 years, and a little, you can see it, little mission congregation with folding chairs, and struggling with files and files of reports that had been sent to the LCA at that time saying we were trying. And one day the telephone rang, and all I heard on the other end of the telephone was this voice that just said, "Can I smoke and drink and be a Lutheran?" And I just kind of, it is Tuesday morning. And so then I paused for a minute and I said, yes, yeah, yes, you really can. And she says, well, thank you. What time are your services? And I told her the time of services, and Vi Rader, her name, was there that Sunday and was there the next Sunday, became part of the ministry of that congregation. 15-20 years later, I was back, and there was Vi Rader. And just this last year, Vi Rader, I read in the church newsletter, Vi Rader had died. But here was a person that gave years and years of faithful life to this congregation because of simply one word. Yes. Yes. And I feel at that moment, you know, I could tell you a lot of stories when I said everything wrong, you know, but I really think at that moment I said it right, according to what the wonder and the beauty of our tradition is, yes. I don't know, does anybody want to, oh, we'll come back to Vi. So another example. I mean, it really makes me nervous to just go on because some of you might think that I'm in favor of smoking and drinking. But I'll take the risk. which is part of our heritage. When I was serving a Lutheran congregation in Albuquerque, New Mexico, we had a very interesting person who joined our congregation, who was an old Catholic priest. And you say, well, why did he join the Lutheran Church? Well, there were no old Catholic churches in Albuquerque, so his bishop, who was back in Cleveland or something, gave him permission. Old Catholic is an old, well, it'd be a long story about a breakoff from the Roman Catholic Church. But he was a kind of a monk who had taken the vows of poverty, and he was a street worker who would, at night, midnight, 1, 2, 3, 4 a.m., would be on Central Avenue in Albuquerque, up and down, in his robe with his cross on the front, being a presence with the prostitutes and the pimps and the homeless people and the runaway youth. He would just be there. And the day he came to say that his bishop had given him permission to join our congregation, and I just said, well, why did you choose us? And he says, I've read about Lutheran teaching. He says, and he says, this is the place that has the word for the people I work with. He says, that doesn't mean anybody knows it in any of your congregations. He says, I'm not saying that, he says, but you have the word, and I want to be part of it. Because he explained to me what those people hear from the church over and over and over is what you ought to be, what you ought to do, what you really should do, how you should shape up. That's what they hear over, that's what they've heard and heard and heard. And he says, I have studied Luther, and you have the word. Well, which leads me to another person, Ted Hutchinson, some of you might know, he works for Region 1 of the ELCA, is an African-American man, wonderful singer and storyteller, deep, wonderful voice. If you ever need somebody to play the part of God, he's great at it. And I asked him, well, how come you're a Lutheran and really want to stay a Lutheran when we tend to be kind of boring? Instead of becoming another congregation that at least sings better than we do. And it was a beautiful moment for me because it was a personal affirmation. He took out a little notebook and he had taken Baptized We Live, this little booklet I did on Lutheran teaching, and he had reduced it down to pages about this size. You know, and he says, the word of grace that you told me in here is what makes me say yes to be part of this tradition. Let me start by saying it in a funny way, or maybe a strange way, but I don't think that we need to talk about churches as to which one is more true and which one is more false. I went to California Lutheran Bible School, LBI. I was a graduate, and this was way back in the 50s and would no longer reflect classes today. But I remember one course we had was Comparative Denominations, and the textbook was by a North Dakota pastor whose name was Casper Nervig. Does anybody remember Casper? The title of the textbook was called The Lutheran Church, The Church of Truth. Right away you felt it might be a little slanted. And the different chapters that went through all of the denominations and kind of labeled them, you know, like Christian Science, a mere grain of truth, almost all error. Roman Catholic, much truth, much error. Presbyterian, much truth, some error. And then the final chapter was the Lutheran Church, the Church of Truth. You know, we don't need to talk that way, because we can talk, I think, about the whole, there'd be a way we could talk about the whole family of humanity this way. From Susan's Bible study, we could talk about all of creation this way, but we can also talk about the whole Christian church on earth this way, as just a beautiful, many-faceted diamond, kind of like this. This is a diamond. That looks something with the many facets. You know, that instead of saying, oh, who's right and who's wrong, you know, who has a truer interpretation of the Bible, is to say that there is a beautiful diamond, which is a whole family of Jesus Christ on earth, and many, many traditions have a facet, a side that shines. And the joy and the glory of each one, and what we want to find in each other, is that shining beauty that comes from your facet. Do you follow me, what I'm saying? And then to ask the question, well, what is those who would follow the Reform movement and Martin Luther, you know, if we have a facet, what is this? And I don't know, there might be different ways of saying it. I like to say it this way, that here is a tradition in the church that is not the only tradition that says this, but in a way maybe has a calling to say, may we be the ones who always say it clearly, intentionally, see it as our vocation and see it as our life. And that is to simply, within the whole beautiful diamond, to shine forth and say, grace. Grace, 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 grace. Our calling is to be a stuck record. Grace, 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 grace. And then here they come again. Grace, 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 grace. You know, I had a friend in San Diego, Jack Lindquist, who was the Lutheran pastor brother, also was the head of this San Diego Ecumenical Council, and did a lot of work in the ecumenical church. And he had a group of Orthodox priests once sit down with him, and they leaned forward to him, and they said, you know, we have no trouble with grace. You know, of course, you know, we are saved totally by God's grace. It is a gift. You know, we don't have any problem with that. But they said, can't you Lutherans ever talk about anything else? You know, and maybe they got it, and maybe they had been with Lutherans that kind of understood their identity and their vocation in the whole church. You know, and maybe the whole Christian church on earth would be a little lopsided. Maybe. You know, if nobody said anything else or held up anything else. But here is our tradition to be those people. And that's why on the back of the little booklet, Baptize We Live, I have just this group of bowling pin people that are just saying, grace, 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 grace. Except the baby who is completely graced by God by infant baptism can't say grace, so it's saying goo. Which is all part of it, is that you're received and welcomed unconditionally long before you can define and say the right words. Unfortunately, in a Spanish edition, they got the O, and they thought the O looked like a D on goo. So it says, gracia, 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 Deus. that's where I wanted to begin with that affirmation. Now, the other important part is that it's okay to be a specific movement within the Christian Church. I like to call our movement as the Lutheran teaching movement in the whole Christian Church. And who was it suggested the problem was when we got organized? Is that what you suggested? You know, and I think one thing we're going to find is that this Lutheran movement in the church never really meant to be organized. You know, it meant to be kind of a little, it meant to be a movement within the whole church, a teaching movement. And we never were very good at being organized. You know, just look at the ELCA. We've never been that good at being organized. But we are a movement within the Lutheran, within the whole Christian church. And there are many others, you know, to think of it like there's the Augustinian movement, there's the Franciscan movement, there's the movement of the Poor Clares, there's the Dominican movement. Yeah, even going back to New Testament times, there's a unity in Jesus Christ and the affirmation that Christ is Lord. But even in the New Testament, you have the Johannine people, and you have the Peter, the Petrine people, and you have the Pauline people, and they're all in the book, and all saying Jesus is Lord. We're able to say, let's all be together in this book. And therefore, part of the call of this teaching this week is to call you who are Lutheran Christians to say, you know, it's not arrogant, it's not a matter of self-pride to truly say we are Lutherans and we will be Lutherans and we'll hold on to this. It's a beautiful gift of a teaching movement within the whole Christian church. So, well, are you with me or following me? Do you remember the one word that I've been kind of emphasizing? Anybody want to try? Okay. I want just part of being in this movement is to realize how much we have been influenced and are part and in spirit with the experience of one man, Martin Luther. And I know even more so in the Bible studies this week, we're going to get into the heart of that wonderful man, you know, who fortunately had so many faults that we've never made a lot of statues of him, you know, and set his statues in every church in little niches with a little kneeling pad and candles on either side. You know, God gave him just enough faults so we wouldn't do that. Isn't that wonderful? He just said enough stupid things. And in our Bible studies this week, I think we're going to get into the wonder of the heart of Luther at his very best, and the spirit of that man. But just as a little background and a review, to remember, Luther was born in 1483. He was at age 21, remember, when you all saw the movie, didn't you? It was the first time I ever went into a theater, was to see Martin Luther, because we weren't allowed to go to shows. And my father just backed down then so we could go see Martin Luther in a real theater. But remember that. But by the way, he goes to movies now at age 87. But remember the movie Luther and the experience of being in law school and the thunderstorm and crying out to his Saint Anne, am I right? Help me. Anne. And then being delivered from that thunderstorm and then becoming a monk, much to his father's despair. And then at 1517, then the nailing of the 95 Theses to the church door, you know, which is really the event that caused the kind of explosion of this Reformation. But I want to back up now to begin to look at Luther and his wonderful teaching to the year 1512 at age 29. And we all remember that Luther's experience of a vengeful, hateful God who was there to punish him, and how Luther's soul was tormented at the anger of God, and how in 1512, reading the book of Romans, chapter 1, as it is written in Scripture, the just shall live by faith, Romans 1:17. And think of the times we've read Romans 1:17 and just walked away and to realize this was the tower experience. Luther said, I felt I was born again. That in that first chapter of Romans, that Luther found a gracious God. Luther was found by a gracious God. And I'd like to pause here a moment because some people say, well, Luther's teachings are irrelevant today because how many people walk around each day thinking, oh, God is angry. There's this big God up there that's angry at me, and how can I appease this angry God? Did any of you think of that this morning as you woke up? If you stand on a street corner, you sense a lot of people under a heavy burden of an angry God who is demanding, and they are seeking ways to reconcile themselves to this angry God. I don't find it really rampant at PLU. So some would say, well, why are we still fiddling around with his experience and holding up his experience as having any relevance today? And the more I realize what he discovered about God's grace, I think provides a wonderful way of freedom in the midst of the deepest concerns of this age and the age in which we live. And it'd be part of my call to us to really hold this up as congregations, as saying something in our world today. I don't know, I was just listening. What do you think people might be worried about today instead of an angry God? What are we worried about?
Money.
Money. Yeah. Will I have enough of it? Will I make money? Yeah.
I think we worry about not living up to other kinds of expectations that are very strong, have strong voices.
Yeah.
You know, what my parents wanted me to be, or you know, what other people expect of me, and so on. Yeah. And never quite measuring up in the same way.
I thought coming to a college, I would find kind of a new generation that had not been raised with kind of perfectionism. Mm-hmm. You know, and you have to do this in order to be a worthy person. And that's happened. I've discovered that at PLU. It would not be at St. Olaf. Right? Or do you know, but to be serious, do you know what I mean? The kind of perfectionism and just under this terrible burden of being perfect. What else do we worry about?
Security.
You know, our security. Yeah. Our safety. Yeah. And which all relates to the whole environmental. Will there be a world to sustain this? You know, will there be a future?
We worry about being loved, being received.
Does anybody really care about me or us? Or the whole question of what's the overused word. I never overuse a word. But the overused word of self-esteem. You know, am I really worth anything? Another the encouragement to watch in the coming presidential campaign. Are most of you citizens of the United States? I assume you're from Canada, so you can just watch this. But if you're lucky enough to be here next week when Marcus Borg is here teaching, most likely he'll really show how at the time of Jesus there was a real purity system in operation, and it was a God of purity and a religion of purity, and you either fit into that or you were out of it. And if you fit into it, you were worthy. If you didn't fit into it, you were worthless at the time of Jesus. And then how Jesus really came and brought a whole new creation, as our Holden theme is, into that world. And look for the purity codes. Look for the purity codes. You know, who is worthy in this nation if it is not the correct type of family? it's already, the code word is family. You are to fitting into this, the closer you are to being worthy. The farther you are away from this, as what's-her-name was on the, what's the TV program? I forget. Murphy Brown. You know, Murphy Brown is far away. You know, and we're going to see emerging many. You know, Dan Quayle will be one. You know, the high priests of the purity religion. You know, defining who is pure and who isn't. And then there can be a whole group in the United States that can really be feel left out, and hopefully enough who feel in that will vote the pure people. I could go.
Just a comment or a concern.
I have no opinions. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, you mentioned concerns, and one of the thoughts that come floating through my mind was the fact that the whole media, and I'm focusing probably more on television than everything else because it seems to be the more pervasive. And on one hand, it may not be a concern per se, but I think it's a concern when you look at the number of hours that the statistics are saying now that children, as an average, watch. And what influence that has on our perception of life and values and things that are important.
Yeah, what is really important?
Because we've taken something other than our own culture, and I mean country, community, family, and thrown a whole different perspective into it that really throws it all up in the air, and it's sometimes get upset as far as sorting out where we are. And as adults, it's one thing, and a little more easy to deal with, maybe. But I'm thinking, where are we going with all this, especially with children, and you know, these questions, I think, are very valid.
Yeah, and I want to just ask the question as we move, you know, what does the word of grace that Luther held up, is it freeing in our day? Is it a word of freedom? Does it create a whole new creation, a whole new world, as our Holden theme is, in the midst of this society?
Only if it's your focus.
Yeah, and you know, and I'll go ahead, I believe it does, you know, and that's why I believe if the Lutheran Church is going to speak to our culture and our society today, you know, let us do what we do. You know, let us hold on to our tradition and let us do it well. So that's, well, I want to begin, before I move on, any thoughts about where I've gone so far? I like to move to 1518. Now, this would have been a year after the nailing of the 95 Theses. And by this time, you remember Luther was a member of the Augustinian Order of Monks. And Augustinian Order of Monks, like any group, has an annual convention. If you ever want to read an interesting story, is to read the biography of like St. Francis and see how St. Francis had to try to keep this annual meeting organized. You know, how does someone who says we completely trust in God for everything, you know, how do you organize a convention? And the Augustinians of Germany met every year too, you know, for their annual meeting. And part of what you do for an annual meeting is say, what should we have for the program? You know, then you have a committee. So anyway, Luther had really become famous by this time because of the nailing of the 95 Theses, and the printing press, remember, had just been invented, and the 95 Theses were going all over Europe, at least northern Europe by this time. Everybody was talking about Martin Luther. So let's have Martin Luther, one of our monks, let's have him do a presentation. But he was asked to present something of a non-controversial nature. So So the topic that Luther chose would be of a non-controversial nature, which was wrong, but simply this: where does God meet us? And this disputation in 1518 took place in Heidelberg, where many of you have floated down the river. Is that right? Heidelberg, this beautiful city in Germany. And there he met, and there he challenged what had been unchallenged for years and years and decades and maybe centuries. And that was the scholastic answer to the question, where does God meet us, or how do we meet God? You know, and the assumption was there. I mean, probably some who went to this annual conference say, why are we discussing this? You know, of course, we have the answers, but maybe we can just kind of talk about them. Where does God meet us? Because the scholastics understood how we meet God, that you go up a ladder of a scholastic, logical, rational thought. And if you use the right and the correct rational thought and arguments, you can gradually reach the proofs for the existence of God. And then when you prove that God exists, then you have met God and you've come to God. You've gone up this ladder of the scholastic exercise, and there is God. And Luther then comes there with this, that we do not meet God. At Heidelberg is where he talked about this now. But Luther talked about is the cross. It is the cross where God meets us. Emmanuel, God with us. And it is not by the scholastic path, but rather it is in our deepest pain, it is in our deepest loneliness, it is in our emptiness, it is in our weakness, it is in our facing death, that there the God of the cross meets us. And Jesus dying on the cross is God's eternal word, that it is in our deepest pain and our loneliness and our weakness and in our suffering that there God is present with us and for us. Can't you just see them saying, wow? I mean, this was a new paradigm. If you went to Matins this morning, this is a new paradigm. And again, Luther here continues to speak, you know, that it is there on the cross that God meets us as the God of grace, who is there loving, forgiving, and embracing in our weakness. I don't know, are there any new forms of scholasticism? Any new ladders? Any new formulas on how we finally successfully come to God? You gotta go on the four steps. You gotta have the right experience. You gotta get yourself together morally. You got to have a faith that's successful. You got to have a successful church that has all this power and glory so you can really feel like, my God is here because we're so successful. Our Mark Spitz father said it many years ago, wonderful theologian of ancient ladder step wisdom. Mark Spitz father said, God loves a winner. He was talking about his son with all the gold medals. You know, here is where God meets you in your success. When you have accomplished, when you have done it, when you have done it correctly, here is God. And Luther, I think, comes with that eternal, a word for every age with its new systems on how we find God and how we get to God and how we reach God and how we make ourselves religious and how we make ourselves spiritual and how we reach more spiritual realms, the word of the cross, that it is in our weakness and in our suffering and in our failure and in our death, and as we face death, that there is God present, suffering with us. Talk to a hospital chaplain in Puyallup who's been a chaplain for many, many years. And I said, what do people do when their whole religious life has been one of God brings you success? You know, if you believe right, you will have success. What do these people do when they're dying of cancer? You know, and he had been with many. You know, and told me about the despair. You know, what do I do? It's not working. And then you have to come up with some new answer, some new rationale, and kind of go into death clinging on to reasons that God is still working. Well, shall I move on? Do you think this is a minority word in the American church or the North American church? How do you think it is?
I remember a couple in our parish in Bellingham who left our church, left the church completely, but their reason was they said we could not endure another Lutheran Lent. He was trying to start a business. She was selling some kind of insurance, a kind of pyramid form of insurance. And they said, you know, you keep talking about God coming to us in weakness, being made known to us when our own strength has run out. And they said, we can't afford to believe that our strength will run out or we won't succeed in our life's goals. They were very, very clear. They were clear about Lutheran theology and clear about why that wasn't going to work for them. Mm-hmm. And it was so hard to have them go because I wondered what would have A.A. Williams.
A.L.
Williams. Maybe some new deal in it. But I remember aching for that because I thought, what happens when that crashes? What happens when this business doesn't work? But maybe it did. Maybe it all worked for them and they're doing just fine. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I think the minority voice is hard to preach because it really isn't what people think they want to hear. As this couple said, we need to feel pumped up when we leave church on Sunday, pumped up, ready to face the challenges of Monday. And Lent was more deflating than pumping for them.
I had an experience several Sundays ago of preaching and how sometimes you don't even know what you've said or done, but don't worry, but it was at First Lutheran in Tacoma, and the text was about the young man who had died and was brought on the bier, and Jesus said, looked and had compassion, and the mother was a widow, and in that society, and so I just leaned over in the pulpit, and I said that one thing we hear and the Jesus we meet here and the God that we meet here is that there's no place anybody in this congregation is today or will be or any pain that you're going through, that God is there and God is loving you and God is with you and God weeps with you and God weeps for you. Then I went on to the rest of the sermon, you know, and didn't realize that this congregation has just, some of you in your congregation, like everybody dies at the same time, you know, a whole group of 80 people in their 80s, you know, and there's just a fountain of grief that's all through the congregation of loss and spouses that have, after 50, 60 years, you know, and And the feedback for just like those two sentences, you know, of saying God is there in your pain. You know, it's again, it's an example of what reaffirms it for me, is that I will not stop saying this, even if it's maybe not the popular message that's going to get on television. Because I believe, you know, that here is the word of the cross that meets the human condition at its deepest, deepest level of real, real life.
I think also one reason that's not a very popular message in the American culture is that our culture says you must be young and beautiful, feeling good forever, you know? And so it's a kind of that we don't want to face the reality that that these times will come.
Yeah, and to actually name that the center of our faith is a God who is with us in our pain and in our weakness. In order to hear that message, I mean, there's something about it that kind of hints around that we might have pain and weakness. You know, it kind of hints at that. And if you really, Douglas John Hall, the Canadian theologian, I think, who speaks so clearly to the North American scene, is a, you know, we are a whole society of denial about our pain and about our weakness. You know, and how do you speak a message, and it's that word of grace that also gives us the empowerment not to be in denial. You know, because my final worth and my standing as a human being does not depend on being strong and perfect.
As one of those who carried 250 people, I think the message at a funeral gives opportunity for the preacher to share about our all of us, our mortal beings. Mm-hmm. And there, because you get so many people that maybe on the edges of the church, never been in the church or whatever, on that success AOA, and I got a brother-in-law that goes from one thing to the next. You know, they're always looking for this height, but they don't have any depth. Yeah. And I think when we talk about Luther and God's grace meeting us at the point of our need, that the psalmist says, whether the course of our life points to the mountaintops of glorious ecstasy or the valley of human suffering, know that God can be with you if you're an A.L. Williams person, or if you're, you know, struggling to know who you are or where you are. It's that continuity of God's grace through it all that I think we as Lutherans can rejoice in.
Yeah, through all of life, just the part of it. Yeah, funerals are kind of these uncomfortable little, you know, they kind of divert us for a few minutes, don't they, in our society? Yeah. Oh, go shoot her hand up first.
Okay. I think as Lutherans, we really do a good job on grace. And I don't want to say we go overboard, but I think we really do. And sometimes we forget, we're so upset with these churches that are all out in the media, that, you know, they do have a message too. And I think Christ also gave that message. And I think there's the balance. There's times in our life when we need grace, but there's times in our life when we need to be pushed. Like, what is it? There's a saying, afflict the comfort and comfort the afflicted. But when we were married, our pastor gave us this little booklet, devotional called Streams in the Desert. I read that thing. It didn't mean a thing. I'd never had a problem in my life. Everything was fine. I couldn't understand. Years later, I picked it up, and it was the most beautiful book I'd ever read. So, I mean, it depends on where you're at.
Well, I'm wondering how this also might relate to our ability to be with the pain of others and the weakness of others. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us would rather, a lot of American people don't want to see the homeless, you know, or don't want to be near the sick or the disabled. And it might, you know, even if we're in a moment of personal relative health and happiness, being able to admit the pain of others into one's life, without being blown away by it, without being destroyed by it or made uncomfortable by it, might be also enhanced by this.
Definitely. The, you know, the response to grace is that love of neighbor, you know, which is really to share that pain. But then, I hope we get into that more, how that pain finally doesn't destroy us. There's that freedom. There's that liberation.
I was want to throw out a thought. How would I strongly feel, especially for older people, on the time of the funeral should be like a celebration, because most of us have led a very beautiful life with very fine families, good children. We have our ups and downs, that's life. But it's a celebration of that person's life. And I've asked my grandchildren, I think they should sing at my funeral, the grandchildren. Of course, one rebels, but they would have things involved. It is a celebration.
Right. One can juggle.
Sure.
At your funeral,
so.
You know, and it would be a real misconception here to, you know, to stop here with, in a theology of the cross, to say the important thing about being Lutheran Christians is that we are gloomy, you know, and focus on the pain, because that's where God meets us. You know, that,
we have that a tiny little church in the town of Houghton, which has 73 people or less, and this happened when I was much younger. One man on the street said, the Lutherans are there, they're celebrating again. It was a funeral. And of course, we served lunch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So there the Lutherans were gathered at that little church celebrating.
And he called it celebrating.
Yes,
that's great.
So. And I never thought of it then as I do now.
Yeah.
But it should be a celebration.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I like the movement away from funerals and to memorial services.
Mm-hmm.
And when my husband died and we had a memorial service, there were so many people, not Lutheran, that came away from that service and they said they had never been to such a beautiful service.
Mm-hmm.
And we sang and we did everything.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't have community. We just did everything.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes. It's wonderful.
Yeah, thanks. So, go ahead.
In relation to this, what we're talking about, the denial type of thing. My mother died last August, and we discovered, this is in Montana, we're all back in Minnesota or scattered around the United States. We get back there to make funeral arrangements and discover that it is not the practice in that town to have funerals in the churches.
I've heard
of
that.
We determined this was going to be a church funeral. The funeral director's nose was noticeably out of joint the whole time. He was, well, just plain rude, because this wasn't the way he saw it. But people had gotten into that habit, that part of the church denied the existence of death by not having the funeral within the church.
Yeah.
And we hope that with the funeral that we said we gave Mom a good send-off. And we hope that this might start the movement back to having funerals.
It helps to have just one person kind of...
It was really very surprising, because that had just sort of, you know, sort of come on over the years, that had become the practice. Nobody was buried in the church.
Yeah, thanks. I'm going to move. Oh, go ahead.
I'm a Catholic, and in our church, quite a long time ago, the funerals were more gloomy and kind of doom, but I think we've moved away somewhat to sort of a celebration type thing. My father just passed away in May, and I think it's easier to have a celebration when it's a person who has led a very long life. And I mean, I don't know how when, we still celebrate, even if it's a child, you know, who dies. I mean, the service is a celebration. So.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure it's very difficult. But certainly, I think as if the person who has died is a person who has led a long, good life, it's much easier. You've gone from the black vestments and so on to the white, and the readings are much more joyous than they used to be.
Now, the question might be, you know, there can be an emphasis on celebration that becomes a denial of any of the pain or any of the reality, or a celebration can be that, you know, the wonderful feasting and celebrating over the word that is there in the midst of the pain and the grief that we recognize. Do you see what I say is the difference between Or, well, what time do we finish this? Oh, I was going to get to the Marburg debate. What am I going to do about that? We'll start tomorrow with the Marburg debate between Zwingli and Luther. So go ahead.
I'd like to go back to her comment about the, you know, the grief amongst humanity and the somewhat denial. You know, so many times we kind of shut our eyes to the rest of the world and we like live in our own little comfortable cocoon. And two thoughts go through my mind. One is, so much of the time we tend to do that to ourselves within the church because most of our mission tends to always be focused on something on the other side of the world. And I'm not knocking foreign ministry, don't misunderstand me, but it's not personal. It's very removed, it's very remote, and it's very easy to shield yourself from the personal impact of the grief that's involved with it. And I'm thinking another session that was going on last week and is continuing part of it this week was, I forget her first name,
Linda.
In talking about elderly people and the problem. And one of the discussions involved what kind of political action we could do and how could we approach the federal government to put in place some kind of a program to relieve this problem. And I'm thinking, now wait a minute. If we're going to help the people on this side of the world over here, why not better start right here and deal with something that may be more painful and more immediate? And I don't have that sorted out, but it bothers me. You know, I'm seeing almost a denial by distance, saying, well, if I insulate it with enough distance, I really don't have to deal with it. Yeah. I'll just throw a little money at it and I'll feel good.
Yeah, we're more separated from the real reality, aren't we?
Yeah.
That brings up the whole point about your many faceted diamonds in terms of the needs and concerns of the people of the world. Probably also the fact that there are people that shine on every facet and can deal with the many needs of the world if we can find out who they are and draw them to the surface and invite them to participate in any needs and concerns.
Because the diamond can also be used as our way of service. Yeah. You know, to be thankful for the many, many gifts.
The church is all about us trying to recognize needs, but then also recognize who's shining on those different facets that can help us.
Yeah. Well, next, tomorrow, I wanted to get to the Marburg debate today because it tied into Susan's Bible study about nature and creation, so we'll do that right at the beginning next time, God present in all creation, and then to move on from there next time to Luther's understanding of living word, which again will tie into the Bible study. Then Wednesday, we are going to talk about, you know, how does this grace incarnate itself in worship, the actual worship life of the congregation. And then I think Friday and Saturday then we're going to actually look at the Augsburg Confession, which is, I know, done almost every week. And then close with some discussion, especially around the theology of the cross, what it means to be people of the cross. So we'll continue this tomorrow. Thank you.